I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 24th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. We're here in the Butrovich Room in Juneau. Committee members present today, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Senator Tobin, and myself, Vice Chair Giesel. Senator Dunbar is excused today. Let the record reflect, we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Marigwin and to Susan, who are taking the records, recording the records and helping us out with the audio. We have two items on today's agenda. First of all, there's a presentation by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and then we're going to have a second hearing for Senate Bill 206, School Suicide Policies, Firearm Storage. So we're going to start with the Mental Health Trust Authority. And so I would welcome forward Dr. Mary Wilson, who is the CEO for the Mental Health Trust Authority, and Katie Baldwin-Johnson, the COO of the Mental Health Trust Authority. Welcome, and you have a presentation to give us.
Yes, thank you very much. So I'm Mary Wilson. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. With me today is Katie Baldwin-Johnson, who's our Chief Operating Officer, and in the back is Allison Bystock, who's our Chief Communications Officer. So thank you very much for having us. Today we're going to talk a little bit about our new strategic plan, trust grant making. We're going to spend some time on our behavioral crisis work, and then look to what's on the horizon, including our overlap with the rural health transformation, and any questions you might have about that.
And committee members, if we could wait till the end of each slide for questions.
Great, thanks. I think many of you are familiar with us and you know who our beneficiaries are. I did want to restate that these are youth and adult beneficiaries, not strictly adults. And we prioritize individuals who are at risk of institutionalization and try to get them proper community help as much as possible. Just a little bit as a reminder about the trust as we dive into more health and social welfare stuff. We're a state corporation within the Department of Revenue, and we administer the Alaska Mental Health Trust, which is a perpetual trust to improve the lives of beneficiaries. Our history goes back, we were as recently as 1994, and the lawsuit was in 1984. So we've been 31 or so years in. And if you have any questions about that.
Seeing none.
Good. This is my 1 year in leadership at the trust, and last year there were some questions, and I thought maybe we could try to make sure we cover those quickly because they're pretty common questions. So is the trust supposed to fund all public mental health and disability services in Alaska? No, we're not. We don't have enough money to spend on that, but it is really written in the statute. We're not intended to supplant general funding for mental health resources, so we want to always be clear about that. Why don't we spend more money on mental health in Alaska? We're a perpetual trust, which means that we have to guard today's spending as well as future spending for beneficiaries in perpetuity. We did go from a 4.25% draw from the permanent fund to a 4.5% draw. That'll be effective in FY26. And we did that based on an analysis of the safety of that number for our future. So we don't think that compromises anything that we do in the future for our beneficiaries. But I just wanted to make that clear. And also, we do spend more year over year because the perm fund and the land we own is earning more year over year. And there'll be a graph later in the presentation when you'll see that graphically, and I think it's pretty impressive what's going on. Why does the trust ask for general funds and MTAR funds? The simple answer is we have an obligation to do so. In addition to allocating trust funds to support beneficiaries, we're statutorily required under AS 4425-270 to provide recommendations to the state for the use of GF dollars to support trust beneficiaries. When we make these required recommendations, we consider the fiscal environment, and we work closely with our executive branch department partners in developing them. We're going to talk a lot about our FY27 general fund recommendations later in the presentation. But it's one of our obligations. And then finally, is the trust improving mental health in Alaska? And that's a really great question. As you know, mental health everywhere, and including in Alaska, is a complex, multifactorial problem. And we do have data that shows that when we give grants, what the outcomes of those grants and the improvement that you may see, and we have a lot of that data available if you need to see it on our website and our documents, and Katie will talk to a little bit of it. But there is work to do in the big problems in mental health that we have in Alaska, and so we partner with others in making ourselves as effective as possible. I will say we have a new strategic plan that I'll talk about, and that we're trying to figure out how to be even more effective than we've been in the past 30 years. But really, it's really population health level stuff is complex. It takes time. It takes agreement and certainty about what to do. And that takes time. Yes.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for answering that question. I do just want to dig in a little bit deeper, because from my understanding, there are certain things that we can improve the circumstances, but not necessarily the issue at hand, like bipolar disorder or folks who are schizophrenic, that those are things that you're not necessarily going to move someone out of those states. And so when you say improving mental health, are you meaning about things like substance use or potentially other types of issues that our citizens experience that we can improve the state of?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mary Wilson, through the chair. When I'm talking about improving mental health, it's if you have a condition, if it's preventable, or there are aspects that are preventable, like drug use with bipolar was one of the examples, you try to do that. But it's really managing a crisis in that mental illness effectively, getting help quickly after a crisis, and then stabilizing and moving on to the best life you can live within that. That's really what we're talking about. Is that helpful?
Thanks. Further questions on slide 4? All right, seeing none.
Thank you. We're really proud this year that we've developed a new strategic plan with our trustees. We have 7 trustees, and we worked together this year to do this. We haven't had a refresh plan in over 10 years. And the reason we felt like, and the team felt like, it was important to do this is because we want to be more impactful and be the best partner we can, so that these big issues are, we can bend those trends in Alaska. And we feel like we're a partner in that, and we want to make sure that we're strategic in our thinking. So when you see our trust priorities, we still are taking care of the same beneficiaries, so that has not changed. But we're going to organize ourselves and operationalize our work a bit differently. Around prevention, you'll see that that's one of our priorities, prevention and early intervention, where that's possible. Crisis response. And we'll talk a lot more about that later. You need to do that very effectively in order to stabilize the population when they're acutely in need. Treatment and recovery, which is right after a crisis. What do you have access to? What works? And are you doing it? Measuring that. And then ongoing support and well-being. How do you live the best life you possibly can live within your community if possible? And moving toward that. Underneath those are really core commitments. And you'll see it's supported by data, partnerships, and stewarding our natural resources. And really, when I was thinking about this, it's almost like an analogy of a tree. The roots we have is the data and our partners and our money that comes in, and then it grows into then the help for our beneficiaries. And so these are the roots, and we work only with partners, really, and our partners inform us. It goes back and forth, and we really need that. The data sort of describes reality, current reality, and then it helps guide your vision. Where are you going based on that current reality? Reality, you need to describe it accurately, no matter how tough that vision that is. And then what's the journey forward? And really describe that well. And then the strategy around that becomes choosing priorities short-term and long-term. And that's what we're trying to get to with this strategic goal. And we've really got a lot of input, of course, with our trustees we worked, but also with partners, beneficiaries, interested members of the public. We took a lot of feedback. We did public commentary on this as well as we went forward, and then ratified it last winter. And we're working on what it's going to look like for our organization, you know, my team. Are we going to be working differently in any way? And are we going to reorganize or whatever? Any questions about that?
I see no questions.
Thank you. We did let you read that. Our trust mission and vision is just revamped in the sense of being really improving upon meeting our beneficiary needs, measuring our impact, and getting there faster and more thoroughly. So now we're going to pivot to trust grant making and tell you a little bit more about that so that we flesh out that part of our business. This is a chart which I alluded to earlier, which shows how much the trust is investing in our partners and communities year over year. This is through FY25, which is our most updated year. Trustees approve spending year over year, and as you can see, there's a trend of increased spending, particularly spending on beneficiaries, which is the medium blue on this chart. I will note that this chart goes through FY25, so it doesn't show the increase I mentioned before of going up to 4.5. We ended up with the increase in FY25 that's so large because of the way we draw from the PERB fund. We take a four-year average as well as other factors. And so you drop off a low year, you get a bump the next year. And that's sort of where that's coming from. Also in FY25, we started including the value of our below-market leases. So we lease to beneficiary-serving groups on trust land, and we give them a good deal on it. And it's about – we are in 25 total – a bit about $1 million worth of below market leases for our beneficiary groups.
Question, Senator Klayman.
When you talk about the permanent fund, are your investments managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, or is there a different permanent fund that the trust does that's different than what we often think of as the permanent fund?
Yeah, through the chair, this is Mary Wilson. The permanent fund manages our investments there. And so in the settlement, we got $200 million 30 years ago, and the million acres of land, and that $200 million is turned into about $800 million.
I see no further questions.
Thank you. So these are the type of trust awards, and we give our grants in two ways. We direct MTAR grant dollars to state agencies. That requires legislative receipt authority. It's our money, but the receipt authority is in your hands. We also award trust authority grants directly to partner organizations. Those are the two big categories. And we have some slides later about those.
No questions on that slide.
All right. This slide offers an at-a-glance look at the Trust FY25 grant awards. There were 149 grants awarded in communities across Alaska. We have five active below-market leases to beneficiary-serving organizations on trust lands that are now reflected in this. The value of our total grant investments was close to $24 million. As you can see from the types of grant awarded, the bulk of our grant making is for direct services and capacity building, but we support everything from planning and the data needs that inform it to actual services and facilities to supporting quality trained staff that work directly with our beneficiaries. We prioritize our spending where it can serve as a catalyst for system improvement, and our grant funds are often leveraged with other community funders. And we have some outcomes reflected in the infographics on the slide as well that you can take a look at. Any questions there?
Any questions? I see none.
So now I'm going to turn it over to Katie to go over some of the grants.
Great. Thank you. And for the record, Katie Baldwin Johnson, Chief Operating Officer at the Trust. So this slide here is a recap for the committee members and for anyone listening in about our MTAR grants to state agencies. They are approved by the Board of Trustees, administered through the state budgeting process. And these grants demonstrate a longstanding commitment to our state partners who serve a critical role in serving beneficiaries. And since inception, we have granted more than $260 million in grants to state agencies in support of mutual initiatives serving beneficiaries.
Next slide. I see no questions.
We provided you a list of all of our MTAR projects, and we won't go through those in detail now. We hope that you reach out if you have questions or you would like to learn more about those projects. And this just kind of shows the breakdown to the different departments and the amount of those grants. And I will highlight that you have a handout that also shows all of the MTAR projects in detail.
No questions.
So So the trust can award grants directly to beneficiary-serving organizations. This is separate from the MTAR grant process. And these are two organizations that serve beneficiaries, nonprofits, providers, local governments, tribal entities, et cetera. And these are important ways that we further our initiatives in supporting beneficiaries. The partnership grants, those are grants that entities apply directly to the trust for an initiative that is supporting beneficiaries. We have the system level types of grants, which are generally mutually developed with partners and trust and the state. We're all kind of working in the same direction. Mini grants are a real, an important part of our grant making, and we hear time and time again from our beneficiaries that these are very important. They are small grants that are applied on behalf of beneficiaries through nonprofit organizations to help meet some of the daily, day-to-day quality of life things. And so we award up to $2,500 annually for an individual beneficiary. And so those have been very important. She mentioned the below market leases. That's another way that we're supporting beneficiary serving organizations. And
no questions. I'll let you go on.
Moving right along. Okay. And then just some of the grant highlights of our authority grants. And I'll just speak to a couple of these here. Set Free, funds to Set Free Alaska, which is an organization in the Matsu Valley that provides services to beneficiaries. These funds were utilized to assist in its therapeutic campus expansion. The expansion essentially will double the capacity of their children and families program and also increase their outpatient program by 75%. Currently, Set Free Alaska serves about 600 beneficiaries per year. With this additional funding and through this project, they'll be able to provide direct services to approximately 337 additional beneficiaries per year. So this is an example of a partnership grant with an organization that is really trying to help address the need for addiction services in the Valley. I also will highlight the South Central Foundation Traumatic and Acquired Brain Injury Project. This has been supported by our Board of Trustees. We're in the fourth year of a five-year project with them. So far, $1.3 million. And this has supported South Central Foundation to complete the planning necessary for them to essentially design and plan a capacity building project to assist in identification of traumatic and acquired brain injuries for their customer owners that they're serving throughout their healthcare system. So it essentially creates and implements a process for early identification and intervention services, and also identifies the system changes with it that need to be made in order to better serve those individuals. So the effort is to ensure that individuals with traumatic and acquired brain injuries are identified and provided supported services at the earliest point in time possible to maximize their quality of life. The long-term goal is to ensure people served by South Central Foundation are routinely screened and that they're connected to the right services, they're assessed appropriately, and are receiving those additional support services as quickly as possible. This project is very promising, there is a strong potential for replication across other services. So we're very excited about that one. Lastly on this, unless there's any questions, I guess I would highlight the
Go ahead and finish.
Volunteers of America.
I'll manage the table. It's okay.
Volunteers of, thank you, Alaska. Trust funding for this project. This was the first withdrawal management facility for adolescents in Alaska. So this is a new service type, and it fills a critical gap in the continuum of care for youth in Alaska. ARCH is available statewide to youth with a substance use disorder who require withdrawal management. They're an 18-bed facility, and they currently serve about 60 youth a year, all of whom are trust beneficiaries.
Very good. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious, do you find yourself tending to give grants to the same organizations year over year, or does it rotate, kind of spread out more?
Thank you for the question. And through the chair, it's a combination of both. I think what we find is that there are a number of organizations that are well established and have the capacity and provide a continuum of services. So they may, like for example, South Central Foundation, they provide a full continuum of services and they serve our beneficiaries in very different ways and different beneficiary groups. So that would be an example of we may be partnering with them on many different types of projects. And we also serve new organizations that the trust has not worked with previously before. So we're constantly looking to expand our reach, and we through our partnership effort and also our outreach with partners across the strait across the state, we find more opportunities to expand our grant making in that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow up?
Yep.
No. All right. I see no further questions.
So the trust engages in many other activities in addition to grant making, and these on this slide are just some of those examples. Through our staff, we have a small but mighty staff that are experts in their respective areas. They often provide technical assistance to organizations on beneficiary initiatives and work with them closely on developing concepts or working towards putting together an initiative that we can partner on. Technical assistance resources is another way that the trust helps support the capacity of organizations to both enhance the services that they provide and also expand and strengthen their services, as well as address gaps in the continuum of care. So the trust offers grant writing and proposal development assistance to aid beneficiary-serving organizations to help them identify and prepare competitive grant proposals to various federal and foundation and other grant opportunities, which is we've found to be incredibly important. A look back over the last 3 years, the trust investment in that resource specifically has generated $45 million in new grant dollars for the state of Alaska and nonprofit organizations serving beneficiaries.
Any questions? Seeing none.
Yeah, so we're gonna move. This is Mary. Thank you. Now we're gonna move on in more detail and profile one of our high impact initiatives, which is the our work on behavioral health crisis response. It's really Katie can talk about it. She was certainly here in the origination, as were many of you. But it's really been a high impact effort. It's not over. But it's really a good way. We're going to try to look back and say, what are the success factors in this that we can replicate in other similar problems as well? But we want to go in detail and just update you on where we are now and how it's going. So this really is just – this slide is just to remind you that mental health is health. So it's the crisis response is modeled after how you would respond to any health emergency. And that's an important thing to remember because it is part of our overall health. Katie?
So at its heart, this crisis initiative, based on the Crisis Now model, which has been adapted and adopted into the SAMHSA best practices in crisis care, it's really about reducing the number of suicides, reducing inappropriate use of emergency rooms and correctional facilities, and providing the best support for individuals in psychiatric crisis. It's been a prioritized initiative of the trust for many years, going back to 2018. Over the last 5 years, roughly 20 million, I think if we go back to the beginning, it's probably closer to 25 million of trust investment into this. And, one thing we'd like to say is that we're a funder. We are not providing the services. We depend on partners that are willing to lean into this space and do this work. So We rely on those champions and communities that want to do something different to step forward and work with us on that. And that's what's been just pretty amazing about this and just watching kind of the evolution of this from the beginning. So working with law enforcement, dispatch, nonprofits, providers, hospitals, et cetera, we essentially have engaged individuals statewide that wake up thinking about this and really want to make a difference in their community about how, at a community level, they respond to folks that experience mental health crises. We started out and we began, in this space, convening really a small group of individuals that kind of came together. And we worked and partnered with the state of Alaska that had looked and explored at some different models. And we kind of ran with that. And early in 2019, we had a convening in partnership with South Central Foundation, and it was one of the first events where we tried to pull together a cross-section of all different kinds of stakeholders. And we took that opportunity to sort of digest a couple of reports that had been done, procured and supported by the trust. One was it was ASHNA at the time, but the State Hospital Association did a study looking at acute behavioral health. It was an acute behavioral health improvement project looking at a lot of data that they were seeing for people presenting and kind of languishing in the emergency rooms. They looked at diagnoses. They were looking at age. They were looking at demographics. They wanted to understand all of those things. As well, at the same time, there was the forensic feasibility study that was done. API was struggling with some capacity issues, and there was also greater demands of the forensic population and those needs being served. And there was a lot of questions about that, like how are we going to tackle that? So kind of pulling those data sources together, we started to sort of see this picture of what was going on in Alaska and really where the pressure points were. And that led us to look at the Crisis Now model as one of those possible frameworks that could get us kind of on the right path moving forward. I will mention that something that's been critical to this initiative moving forward is that we don't have the capacity as staff to support this just ourselves. We've had to have additional capacity through technical assistance and project management support. So Agnew Beck has been really our partner in this work in helping us kind of keep momentum on the initiative, but also being the experts supporting and working with our partners as they look to implement new services, explore new models. Is it feasible? Can they fund it? Are there revenue streams? Will the community support it? Will it work in those communities? Those are all really important questions. So that's been an important part of it.
Senator Klayman has a question.
So I know a part of that, which Senator Giesel and I were involved with, was the crisis intervention legislation. And then a couple of years later was the crisis residential legislation. And my question is, should we be aware of additional legislative matters we should be thinking about helping out with on this same process? Because I know that those were the two big pieces of legislation and they are now law. But are there other legislative pieces that we should be aware of moving forward?
So thank you for the question. And at this point, I don't have a response to that. But I think as we continue to work on this with our partners, we're thinking about policy. We're thinking about, where are the snags and kind of the bottlenecks? What are we running into? Organizations that were wanting to move forward with crisis stabilization, we didn't have the regulations in place yet. And so we saw entities still moving forward, knowing that those would come. But also committed to designing the programs. And, that's been a very interesting process, but it's worked well partnering with the state and trying to work through some of those issues. But absolutely, I think, as we learn more about it and as we work to see sort of how the system works together, which is really what the intent is, right now we're starting community by community, kind of program by program. But I think that we'll see more of those policy issues emerge as we do more of this work.
Good. All right, I'll let you proceed.
So this slide here, community adaptations. I think when we started this initiative, I think one of the criticisms was, is this is a model that you're bringing back from outside of Alaska, and then you're going to make it fit in Alaska. And our communities across Alaska are different, and we recognize that. What this did was actually give us sort of a framework. Like if you had somebody to call and you had somebody to respond and there was a safe place to go, what would that look like in your community? So what we had seen is over time, the communities are really designing what works for them. This slide shows that, in Anchorage, we have 911 transfers to Caroline. That's been a work in progress. Caroline is our statewide crisis call center. I'll talk a little bit more about that here in a moment. We have modifications to the type of mobile response. We have behavioral health mobile crisis teams, which is a master's level mental health clinician or behavioral health specialist with a peer. Those teams are very effective. We have co-response teams. The Anchorage Police Department has a co-response team, which is a law enforcement officer with a mental health specialist or a social worker. Mobile integrated teams, which is the paramedicine model of a paramedic in a fire department paired with a mental health specialist that go out to the communities. These are operating in many communities now, and we have more communities reaching out that are interested in seeing how they can expand and develop these programs as well. I want to point out that you have a handout that is the it's a timeline, and there's a lot on it. It's a very dense document, but it only goes up to 2024. We need to update that. But in addition to what's on that timeline, just in 2025 to 2026, some of the things that have taken place, I want to highlight some of those if I can. Mm-hmm. In April of 2025, the Alaska State Troopers signed a memorandum of agreement with the Fairbanks Mobile Crisis Team for the state troopers to dispatch the mobile team to their jurisdiction in the North Star Borough. This increased the Alaska Behavioral Health, which is providing the mobile crisis response in Fairbanks, from averaging 90 per month to over 150 dispatched responses, with a 98% success rate of stabilization in community. We see mobile crisis teams launched on the Kenai with Central Peninsula Hospital in December of 2025. The trust is also working with the Family Health Clinic, the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association, and the City of Unalaska for the planning and design of a therapeutic safe room for beneficiaries with mental health and behavioral health crises so they're not held in jails. See, that's a local adaptation to something. We need something different than jails. Also, the trust is providing some technical assistance to the Nenana Fire Station and the Rail Belt Clinic around planning and implementation of a mobile integrated health team. The Ketchikan Mobile Integrated Health Team is continuing to build community trust by meeting over 1,000 contacts since June of 2024 and reducing high utilizer inpatient use at Peace Health Emergency Room Department by 54%. So at local levels, our partners are looking at the data that they have available to them to see what their impact is and using that.
Very good. Senator Klayman.
You're just supplementing the sheet that was in our packet but is not a slide?
Correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. No further questions.
Thank you. So as Alaska communities continue to launch and implement coordinated crisis services, data plays a critical role. It helps us answer key questions. Are these services being utilized? Are they effective? And do they measure up against best practices? And in some cases, it's not unusual for organizations to have not yet looked across system silos to integrate data sources. But this is exactly what's needed. And without that collaboration, we miss the opportunities to see the full picture of how these services impact individuals and communities. So it's very much work in progress. But what is encouraging is that many of our partners and organizations are deeply committed to use of data to improve practice and drive improvements. So this is the CareLine dashboard. CareLine is the state contracted crisis services call line for the state of Alaska. They recently launched this dashboard, which they have available. It's public facing. And it essentially offers a snapshot of how their crisis response is functioning as it relates to the call center. So it shows utilization trends, monthly call volume. These metrics also on service are showing, are they effective? Are they responsive? So this is very valuable information to have available to look to see how they're doing. And I would also say that in other ways, our mobile crisis teams are also tracking, how many individuals, how many calls they're responding to, what's their stabilization rate in community. And we're also seeing local crisis collaboratives. Anchorage has a crisis collaborative, which are all the partners that are engaged in the work. The Matsu Valley has the same. Ketchikan has that. Juneau has that. They are all looking at the data to try to understand what's happening in their community. So if you might advance to the next slide.
Yes, no questions.
So the initiative is definitely benefiting from increased awareness around the mobile teams. That's what seems to get most press, and we're seeing more about that. We have the Daily News Miner here and the Frontiersman. Great things are also happening at a local level. You can see that here. The box in the center is taken from the municipality of Anchorage's crisis response dashboard presentation, and they're monitoring this within the municipality of Anchorage. So the city is doing great work to track and understand and share the investments and initiatives across the municipality's behavioral health crisis response system. So this is just an example of coordination and looking at data to try to understand the system and find opportunities of how to work better together and how to improve.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm curious to know, as you're tracking this information and collecting this data, how is it informing your prevention side of the work?
Great question. I think it's informing in the sense that we're learning from the providers that are providing these services, and they're the ones that are seeing the types of resources that are needed and supports for the individuals that they're encountering. They're offering the interventions that that are needed at the time, but it also informs how can we look at supporting programs that help people earlier. Help people access services earlier before it becomes the crisis. So that's what I would say. It also relates to sort of the way the strategic plan is structured, is that when we're looking at, you have to look at what's creating the crisis, you have to care for the crisis, and you want to support them reintegrating back into the community. But we have to look at all of that.
Okay. All right, no further questions.
Thank you. Briefly, this reflects the FY27 general fund recommendations that our trustees made. And just to highlight, the crisis call center is the item that we had included in the operating budget. We are very committed to supporting the crisis call center. We feel it's very important. It is obviously one of the services that serves statewide, all communities can access that. And, we will continue to advocate for that. We developed those recommendations in partnership with the Department of Health, and we will continue to work with them to, ensure that the call center remains a supported and stable component of our system of care. Also, just to highlight in the capital budget, the special needs housing grants and the homeless assistance programs. Also, we have those identified. There were a general fund recommendation in that. And we did, the governor did support those programs through AHFC receipts. So we have a much, I'd say, a smaller general fund budget request this year. We look forward to more of those conversations related to that.
Good. Any questions? All right. Seeing none.
Great.
All right. A little bit about rural health transformation. You know, as we're a grant maker and a change agent, as I hope you've seen, so we're really well suited to support rural health transformation. It's like hats off because the run for the money worked. The money came in. And as you know, it has to be spent October to October. And so there was sort of a group that started with the commissioner around just getting to make sure that application was done. And they solicited input from groups like us about what would you think would be important and so on. And we visualized that. So that process went well. Now there's the next phase, I would say, which is how do you sort of get an overarching strategy? What are your priorities? And so on, as well as the side-by-side grant-making part of where the money's going to be going. So we have a spot on that advisory group that's being formed that has just been chartered. We'll tag team on it. So we'll see. I just read the charter earlier this week, so it's really going to be a upper-level group. There's going to be different ways that I think are still being sorted out, how money's going to get out and what the priorities are going to be. But it's really an opportunity for us in Alaska to look forward over 5 years and think strategically and meaningfully about where the most biggest impacts can be, what we want them to be, and then go from there. So we're excited. The other aspect of it is that there are things, as you know, that the money can't be spent on. And so are there ways, and we've met with the other grant makers and talked about this as well, are there ways that we'll be leaning in to help with things that aren't covered, if that's appropriate and something we can cover as well. So there's overlap potential, information potential, and then just expertise potential from our staff.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Seeing none.
And this is okay. This is the last slide, so we made it. We of course we have our. I just want to mention a few things that we're excited about. Our ongoing grant making is going well. Every quarter we get our new batch. We got maybe 51 new requests last week for this quarter, so we'll be going through those. And that's a cycle where people but things bubble up to us that communities think they need, and then we also look sort of out and say, here's what we think might be needed. So it's a bubble up and an overarching impact strategically. So we'll tell you more about all that next year when we get some of these other initiatives done and we see the overlap. We're also beginning our FY28 budget planning work. And we do use a stakeholder driven process. Like I said, it's the sort of the roots on the tree. So we really do cast a wide net in the communities and in the boards and the stakeholders and the other experts, U of A, and just come in and inform the decisions that we make. What's possible? What would we like to do, et cetera? And then a big thing I hope that some of you can attend, we have our third Improving Lives Conference, which is in Anchorage in September. We'll post the dates. But it's a two-day conference that brings together trust beneficiary populations. It was launched in 2022, and it's been held every other year. It's really an opportunity to explore innovative practices, strengthen collaboration, and support of trust beneficiaries. We had, I think, 400 participants in 2024. I went myself, even though I didn't have this job yet, but it really made me think I should take that job if they offer it to me, because it's really exciting work that will be showcased there. So really, the only other thing I would add is, as you know, we have some gnarly mental health problems in Alaska. There's no doubt in my mind that can get better with time, but it really takes, it's a complex problem, and it takes collaboration, agreement, energy, and strategy. And that's what we're here to help provide. So thank you very much, and we'll take any other questions.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wilson. Any questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Klayman.
Not really a question, but just a comment that getting the new strategic plan that hadn't really been updated in 10 years and integrating that into the operations. It appears from the presentation today that that probably wasn't an overnight process to update the strategic plan. And I really compliment you all on doing that because it's easy to lose track of the importance of having a strategic plan. So just thanks for doing that.
This is Mary. Thanks for the comment. And I agree. And I have to thank not only the team at the Trust. I've worked with a lot of different – I've been a leader of a lot of different high-functioning teams and groups. This group is second to none. They are unbelievable, partly because they're open to change, which is hard. And they're not sticking with all the old ways all the time. They're really saying, what can we do better in the next iteration and the next iteration? That's pretty remarkable. And then I think I've been very fortunate in the trustees because they have an appetite to move forward into different spaces and to understand data and to get educated on what might have an impact. So it's really lucky for me that we've got a confluence of those things because getting people to form a strategy is not easy. And then operationalizing it is probably the next hard part. But we'll see how that goes. Report back.
Sounds like stuff we try to do as well.
Yeah.
I had a question on page 15 or slide 15. You said next free grant writing workshop, April 1 to 2. And so that, of course, led me to think about the rural health transformation. I know entities that are putting in applications to the RHTP often need help with grant writing. Sounds like you'll be one of those entities that might be able to help them. Is that possible?
That's possible, and it sounds like that to us as well. The whole details of that are still a work in progress, but yes, we'll be available to what makes sense for us to be available for sure.
Very good.
And we work closely with the community health, with that team anyway.
With the foundation?
Yeah.
The community foundation? Very good. And I am interested in the Improving Lives conference. I'll definitely be watching for that.
Good, good. Thank you. We would love to have you there.
Yeah, that looks great. Any closing questions, committee members? Seeing none. Thank you very much for being here, Dr. Wilson and Katie Baldwin-Johnson. Thanks for that presentation.
Thank you to all of you for listening so carefully. Thank you.
All right. The second item up today in our meeting is Senate Bill 206, School Suicide Policies, Firearm Storage. Very relevant to what we've just been talking about. This bill is sponsored by Senator Tobin, and there is a committee substitute and a summary of changes before us. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Vice Chair Giesel. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 206, version 34-LS1233/N, as in November, before the committee as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And I believe Mr. Flora is here, staff to Senator Tobin, who will go through a summary of changes.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. For the record, my name is Louis Flora, and I'm staff to Senator Lukey Tobin. In the end version before you, we have a few changes. The first change you'll see is we've deleted from the previous version the incident reporting requirement to the child advocacy centers, and this appeared in Senate Bill 206 version A on page 1, lines 11 and 12. And this was a proposed addition to current statute at AS 1433-220B, which is the duty to report harassment and bullying. The next change, we have added and crisis intervention to page 1, line 10, CSSB 206 version N. And we've also added obtain a suicide risk assessment or screening from a healthcare professional to page 1, lines 12 and 13 of CS 206 version N. And that was at the suggestion of the Alaska chapter of the American Society for Suicide Prevention, just to strengthen the information that can go to parents when there is an instance of suicidal ideation expressed or bullying. We also added or to hunter or firearm safety programs that are administered by a school district to page 2, lines 9 and 10. And this is just to make sure we capture existing programs in the schools, extracurricular and otherwise, that are exposing young children to firearms and firearm safety, just to integrate that. And finally, we changed the agency responsible for the Firearm Safe Storage Grant Program from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Administration on page 2, lines 4 and 19 of CSSB 206 version N. And that was due to the discussion we had with the Department of Public Safety that this would be a new grant program that they were not set up to administer. And so we did transfer that to the Department of Administration, which contains a division of procurement. And we are in the, so we thought that was a more appropriate agency. And then there was a reordering of the last paragraph, in last section in the bill, just because we, by pulling out the Department of Public Safety and putting in the Department of Administration, it changed the ordering of the bill, but no substantive changes made.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking on page 1 of the bill. We've got, starts off, a school district may adopt a plan to notify the parents or guardians of a student of an incident of harassment, intimidation, or bullying involving the student or a threat of suicide by the student. Which all sounds good, but then the very next sentence only carries on with the threat of suicide. And what I'm concerned about here is we're focusing, it feels like we're focusing on the victim, but not necessarily the perpetrator. And in some ways, the perpetrator actually of a incident of harassment, intimidation, or bullying might need some attention as well. And so my question there is why we've only focused on the one side of the equation, so to speak.
Mr. Fuller, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Myers, that would be a policy call on the part of the committee. We focused on the side of the victim of the harassment just to ensure that the resources were getting to that family most immediately, but definitely we could have that discussion.
Further conversation, Senator Myers?
A thought that, you know, as I'm thinking through various incidents that we've had in schools, a little bit around the state, more so around the nation, that, the threats of suicide, of course, that's the larger number that we're dealing with in most cases. But, you know, the perpetrator of an incident of harassment or bullying of some kind, that can sometimes then manifest itself out, and we either as a threat to themselves or a threat to others. And, if we're going to talk about securing firearms so that they aren't used in those types of situations, I think that's something we should probably think about expanding into. Thank you.
Very good, Senator Myers. You could possibly consider an amendment, but good points. Further questions or comments related to the bill? Senator Clayman.
I very much support adding crisis intervention. We heard all about it in the last presentation. I think it's fully appropriate to be in there.
Very good. All right, seeing no other comments, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to the adoption of the bill? Then this committee substitute is before us. So at this time, thank you, Mr. Flora, for that review. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony. There we go. Sorry, I had a tablet on top of it.
That's a muted one.
Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on the bill? Let me see. Let me hold steady. Did you, and I assume you guys signed in outside? Okay. Let me take a look here. It's hard to tell who's in the room. And here we go. Here's the in-the-room people. All right. So first on the list, I see Jan Caulfield. Caulfield? There we go. Very good. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right. There are quite a few people, so what I'm going to do is limit testimony to 2 minutes.
Sounds great.
All right.
Thank you very much, Chair Giesel. My name is Jan Caulfield. I live in Juneau. I'm speaking for myself, and I really appreciate this opportunity. I strongly support SB 206 and its intent to reduce the number of youth suicides in Alaska. The risk of suicide by gun is high in Alaska. Guns are the leading cause of death of our children and teens. We have the third highest rate of gun suicide in the United States, and it's more than double the national average. Alaska's 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that 1 in 5 high school students in Alaska had seriously considered suicide in the past year. 59% of these students said that they could access a loaded gun, and that stat was as high as 65% in one region reported in that YRBS. While many Alaskans do store their guns locked, these student-reported statistics show that we clearly do have a major problem with access to guns as a means of youth suicide, and that lives can be saved if you and the rest of the legislature take action and support getting these gun safety devices and education to families through this bill. This bill will save lives by providing time between suicidal thought and action. Suicide attempts using a gun are fatal 9 times out of 10. More than 90% of people who survive a first suicide attempt by any means do not go on to die by suicide in the future. But if their first attempt is with a gun, then they rarely get a second chance at life. Alaska's statewide suicide prevention plan, the current one, which is 2023 to 27, prioritizes reducing access to guns during crisis. So this is a state plan. Goal number 3 states, quote, firearms continue to be the leading means of suicide in Alaska, and properly educating people about safe gun storage can greatly reduce someone's odds of dying by suicide. Firearms are the most lethal among suicide methods, so it's important that during a crisis they are removed or they are locked very securely, unquote. So in summary, I urge this committee to listen to Alaska's Suicide Prevention Council and to the Alaska chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Alaska League of Women Voters, and the many other statewide organizations that support secure gun storage to save lives of Alaskans. So I urge you to pass the bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up on the list is Laura Fleming. And then after Laura will be Luann McVeigh. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Giesel and members of the committee. My name is Laura Fleming. I live in Juneau. And I thank you for holding a hearing on this bill and taking public testimony on it. I'm so glad to see this happening. I urge you to take action on the measure and pass it out of committee with a favorable recommendation. And I look forward to the day when its provisions are enacted into law, for it is sure to reduce the number of deaths by firearm in Alaska. Many of us have firearms in our homes and take responsibility for ensuring they are safely stored, but sadly not enough of us. A terrible price is being paid in terms of lives lost, particularly young people's lives. How can we not address this scourge? How can we allow firearms to remain the leading cause of death for children and teens in Alaska? Please enact this measure. The Alaska public and parents, if they're educated about the importance of secure firearm storage, will improve. They'll improve their performance, and we will reduce deaths by suicide. We have the country's 3rd highest rate of suicide. Alaska's gun suicide rate is more than twice the national average. It doesn't have to be this way. We can do better. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right. Next up was Luann McVeigh, and after Luann will be John Sonnen. Welcome, Luann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to testify as well. I'm a retired teacher, Alaskan teacher, so I've worked with a lot of kids, and from little up to 7th grade. And so to me, this is a really important opportunity. SB 206, by creating the Firearm Safe Storage Fund within the Alaska General Fund, would give school districts the opportunity to provide gun safety education, but also to provide safe storage devices to Alaskans. I see it as a way to address the that critical need to fight those horrifying statistics that a couple of ladies just mentioned. I think it will help us to be more vigilantly proactive about protecting against the scourge of gun deaths in our state. I also know a little bit about that 2023 to 2027 statewide suicide prevention plan and how it advocates for reducing access to lethal means during times of crisis. I was thinking about how during a time when a person is at their lowest, they might have the impulse to take one's life with a gun. And if the guns are locked up by safes or gun locks, it gives some time between that suicidal thought and the action. The action can make all the difference. And I think that's the main intent of the bill. I really encourage reading that suicide prevention plan. I think it has some really strong information in it. And I commend Senator Tobin for introducing this bill, and I strongly urge you to pass it out of committee. It's a solid first step at reducing Alaska's horrifyingly high suicide rate and protecting our young people. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So John Sonnen is next up here in the room.
That's me.
And then after Mr. Sonnen, we will be going online for testimony.
Okay, pronunciation is Sonnen, John Sonnen. I live over on Douglas, and happy to see you folks here, the committee, Chair Giesel and committee members. I can tell you that I'm finding that my only fear anymore is for the future that we're leaving for our children. And I say my only fear, of course, immediate things might be fearful, but my only fear that I live by, unlike many people that live in fear, is that our kids are not going to be able to enjoy at least the quality of life I did. The number one issue for this bill is safe storage of relentless and prolific firearm use in this culture that has become more and more, it seems to me, trended towards impulse reactions. People don't have time to process, digest, and emotionally, that's probably my problem, emotionally respond to a situation. They need to react impulsively and assume that everything is considered in their split decision. But when it comes to the lethal and deadly, oftentimes unsecured firearms in Alaska, and many times, I don't know how the trafficking of unregistered, unlicensed firearm ownership is, but many times I'm sure the prolific traffic of firearms makes their security and storage out of the hands of the impulse children.
Mr. Sonnen, I'll have you wrap up now.
Ms. Chair Giesel, I'll be wrapping up.
We have quite a few people waiting. Thank you so much for testifying.
Allowing time for processing of a situation is important and safely secure.
We will go on now. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
We have a long list. So now I'm going to go on the phones. And to start out is Jim Haslett. I'm doing this in the order that folks signed on. He's calling in from Wasilla. After Mr. Haslett will be Rick McClure in Anchorage. Mr. Haslett, can you hear us? And if you would introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, I can. I'm James Haslett. I appreciate the opportunity to talk. First, let me say I'm disappointed that the bill is not in its updated form online as I look at it right now. That puts those of us who aren't in the know at disadvantage. So I'm just going to continue with my comments from earlier as I prepared them. This bill requires staff, volunteers, and children to report incidents, not only to school personnel, but also to the Child Advocacy Center, CAC. Now, I understand that's recently been removed. I just haven't seen it. On page 1, line 9 of the A version of this bill, it even mandates all personnel shall report the incident to the school or the CAC. The purpose of the bill doesn't require the school or the CAC to notify the parents or the guardian. Very disappointing. You tell the school, and maybe the school will tell the parents. That doesn't sound very effective in any kind of prevention to me. Then on page 291-8, they say the school district notifies the parent or guardian must perform three specific steps. They must limit the student's access to firearms and illegal medications. They have to advise the parents of this. They need to securely store firearms, ammunition, and lethal medications, including in a safe storage device. Now, I bring up the lethal medications because it drops off pretty much from there. Nobody cares if they kill themselves by pills or other drugs, just firearms. They can request a free storage device, firearm storage device, through the school district. Apparently, as I read down through the rest of version A of this bill, but there's nothing that says the school district has to contact them, let alone give them anything. It's a choice of each school district. Pretty much taking the teeth out of this law totally. The firearm storage gun, if established, I mean, no cost to the school, you're going to give them these devices. Now, whatever that is, it could be a Glock box, it could be a safe, it could be a gun lock. And with that, I am just going to close. I know I'm out of time. We're saying that this bill isn't worth passing in its current state. Frankly, it does nothing but
hijack
gun control in the hands of government or other entities, and it doesn't belong. We have a constitution for that.
Thank you, Mr. Haslett, for your testimony. Next up is Rick McClure. After he, we will go to Irene Bortnick. Mr. McClure, calling in from Anchorage, president of the Alaska Gun Rights Association.
Good afternoon. My name is Rick McClure, president of Alaska Gun Rights, vice chair Giesel, and members of the committee. SB 206 is being marketed as a suicide prevention and school safety measure. The factual language of the bill embeds firearms into the harassment and suicide reporting system and creates a new firearm storage, safe storage scheme inside the Department of what was public safety, now it would be the Department of Administration. And in the fiscal notes, according to the Department of Public Safety, and it would be the same with the Department of Administration, this bill creates a new structural program requiring dedicated staffing, procurement, distribution, reporting, and regulatory oversight. It has a new position in ongoing general fund spending to administer a firearm storage program. This is not just information. It is a state-managed firearm infrastructure and regulatory authority. SB 206 conditions parents who have committed no crime to accept state direction on how they store constitutionally protected property, inserts child advocacy centers to school reporting, and then ties that to the firearm access messaging. SB 206 shifts firearms from being a constitutional right to being treated as a public health hazard managed by the state. This is a dangerous precedent. And let's be clear, nothing in this bill stops violent criminals. Nothing in this bill punishes criminals. Instead, it builds a regulatory framework aimed squarely at law-abiding families. Once the state builds the infrastructure, future legislatures can mandate participation, force a multitude of requirements, and attach penalties. Alaska's constitution is clear. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. SB 206 lays the groundwork for future infringement under the plea of emotional manipulation. For these reasons, I respectfully urge you to vote no on SB 206. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClure, for your testimony. Next up, as I said, we're going to Irene Bortnick. She's calling in from Anchorage. After Ms. Bortnick, we will go to Ron Bernier in Meadow Lakes. Ms. Bortnick, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. To the chair and members of the committee, my name is Irene Bortnick, and I'm calling from Anchorage representing myself. In full disclosure, I am married to someone who owns firearms, each of which is locked and secured in a safe. This bill acknowledges two facts. Children may be bullied or harassed, and Alaskans own guns. It does not infringe on Second Amendment rights, but serves to educate the public on the need for safe storage. Cost should never be a deterrent for keeping our children safe, the cost for not keeping them safe, including the financial cost, but not least of all, is much higher. We know, too, that firearms are the number one cause of death for Alaska's children and teens. Alaska has the third highest gun suicide rate in the nation. Firearms are the most lethal among suicide methods, and even a short delay in access can make a difference. I urge you to please vote in favor of SB 206, which will go a long way to protecting our most valuable resource, our youth. Thank you for your time and for the work you do.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bortnick. We'll go next to Ron Bernier. Before, however, you begin, Mr. Bernier, I do want the committee to know that Captain Scott Bartlett is online for questions. He's a captain in the Alaska State Troopers Department of Public Safety. Mr. Bernier, you are next, and you will be followed by Pamela Samish. Mr. Bernier?
First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out. I would like to opposition of 206. It is any. This is a storage issue for guns to prevent suicide. Any responsible parent has already got their guns locked up. Here in the borough, I took and did a resolution in the Madison Borough to encourage its residents to maintain a firearm and ammunition for protection of their families and in their communities. And along with that, I did a $75,000 grant for gun safety training. Maybe you guys could go down that avenue into the gun safety training, implement that in the schools. The high risk of suicide has a lot to do, I imagine, with the LGBTQ stuff that's taught in school, the different things like that on social medias, getting away from the two parent families, the man and the woman. I oppose 206, and I'm speaking on my behalf as Ron Bernier, not as Madison Borough Assembly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernier, for your testimony. Next up is Pamela Samash. I'll let her correct my pronunciation. She's calling in for me, Nana. After Pamela will be Dr. Victoria Kildall in Kodiak. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you so much, and you're doing a wonderful job directing testimonies, by the way. my name is Pamela Samash. I live in Nanana, Alaska. I oppose SB 206. I really liked the testimony right before me, and I would like to ditto that. I also wanted to say that I work in a school, and we are already aware of bullying. We already have training on how to see kids that seem mentally or emotionally unstable. And unlike this bill, if we see any red flags, we just talk to the parents. We just have a meeting with the parents. Like, we don't need a bill. And we're not going to tell anybody to lock up their guns. I mean, we live in the Nana. If a bear runs through my yard, I can't settle with a gun case. I need to just have a gun with bullets ready to go. Like, the gun doesn't kill the people. What kills, it's like what the man said before me, that what hurts the children is the lack of family support. So the key is family support. You know, the key is working together with the family and love and compassion, counseling, mental health. I'm all for that stuff, but no way are we going to tell people to lock up their guns. That's never going to happen. and also the bill does, it says that they may contact the parents. We always contact the parents. That is the number one source of protection for our children. And if they're, and bullying is not allowed in the school. We already got rid of that. So we don't need the bill. So I oppose it. But thank you for, anyway.
Thank you for your testimony, Pamela. So next up is Dr. Victoria Kildall in Kodiak. She'll be followed by Layla Berbervik in Anchorage. Dr. Kildall, welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Victoria Kilbell, and I currently serve as the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. I'm a lifelong Alaskan and have been in the behavioral health field as a direct service provider, supervisor, and administrator for over 20 years. Alaska continues to face one of the highest suicide rates in the country, and youth suicide remains a serious public health concern. Unfortunately, I have personally experienced the devastating effects of losing a close family member to suicide and still feel the impacts of that loss. Suicide prevention is not abstract policy. It has lasting consequences for families and communities across our state. We appreciate the intent of SB 206 to strengthen school-based suicide prevention efforts and to address access to lethal means during periods of crisis. Reducing access to lethal means during moments of acute risk is a well-established suicide prevention strategy. The proposed Safe Storage Grant Program is a practical step that can support families when it matters most. We also support parent notification when a student is at risk of suicide, but we also encourage that implementation be handled thoughtfully and carefully. Policy should include clear, trauma-informed guidance so students continue to feel safe seeking help. Finally, we recommend that districts adopt notification policies, also establishing clear referral pathways to local behavioral health providers so that when parents are notified, they are immediately connected with appropriate clinical resources in their communities. Schools cannot manage suicide risk alone, and families need timely access to care. Alaska's behavioral health providers stand ready to collaborate in strengthening coordinated community-based suicide prevention efforts. Thank you for this opportunity and for your time today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Dr. Kildall. Next up is Layla Berberowicz, and after she is Teresa Lewandowski. Layla, welcome.
Hello, thank you so much. I would like to thank you for your time and consideration to hear my thoughts today regarding the benefits of this bill. I am a licensed mental health professional in Alaska, and my number one concern that is in the back of my mind daily is someone losing hope completely and wanting to end their life. My whole career and professional dedication is focused on helping people avoid getting to that point. If unfortunately they are there already, my job and is in helping them turn the other way and start feeling more empowered to feel better. Now, we know that studies show the time between suicide ideation and action. Time is the most effective tool in preventing ultimately death. It allows a person a moment of hesitation, which can provide space for alternate options, calling a loved one. I believe this bill would be another step in ensuring our youth are residing in a healthier society than we have found it. Teaching our community members through including parents and kiddos to set themselves up for success by educating them on safe storage of firearms and giving them the resources to practice that, safety is crucial. I believe this bill would assist ensuring that our goal is achieved of healthy communities. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 206. I appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you, Layla. Could you introduce yourself for the record in your own words?
I'm sorry?
Could you introduce yourself for the record? You didn't state your name at the beginning.
I apologize. My name is Layla Berberowicz. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself.
Thank you very much, Layla. Thanks for your testimony. Next up in Homer is Therese Lewandowski. She will be followed by Michelle Champion. Therese, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Therese Lewandowski. I'm in Homer, and I'm speaking for myself. Thank you for hearing this bill. I think it's a great bill. I think a grant fund to provide safe storage and gun locks to school districts for families is a great idea. I looked at the PowerPoint on this with its stats and gun storage, and the info is, I'm sure, right on. We all know suicide prevention is multifaceted. Safe gun storage is one essential tool. Speaking to some of the previous testimony, you know, sure, involved parents and smart parents will lock up their guns, but it never hurts to put out more education because we still have youth suicide. We still have a lot of bullying. I know people in Homer that have taken their kids out of public schools because of the bullying. So anyway, education and intervention is another tool for prevention. And you know, youth are vulnerable. They are easily led and prone to withdrawing. They should not grow up being frightened or believing bullying is cool. A young bully grows up to be a dangerous adult bully. So please support this bill. I like all the ideas. It sounds like it has some kinks to work out regarding notification of parents when there is bullying incidents and how the whole grant fund is going to work. But I think it's a great idea to put education out there and give families the tools for doing this. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Therese. Next up is Michelle Champion in Anchorage. She'll be followed by Rochelle Parker. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow members of the committee. My name is Michelle Champion. I live in Anchorage, and I am representing myself. I'm asking you for a vote of support for Senate Bill 206. I would like to see this bill become law. I worked at the Anchorage School District for 20 years as an occupational therapist. My job entailed working with students who had disabilities, everything from cerebral palsy to autism to fetal alcohol syndrome. Some of these students that I worked with, especially at the middle and high school levels, also demonstrated what I would call self-esteem issues beyond what I would describe as typical or developmentally appropriate. They appeared depressed, fearful, and isolated. At these times, I spoke with a counselor or assistant principal out of my concern for these students. It would be excellent if the school district professionals could respond in these situations with education to the families and strategies for the families, specifically devices for locking up guns for some of these high-risk students. Senate Bill 206 would make that easier by providing education and easy access to safe gun storage devices for families of these youth who are at risk. My experience of being out in the community and talking with families about gun safety only confirmed that parents and youth are very interested in learning about safe gun storage. They asked lots of questions, and it was evident that as gun owners, they did not want firearms getting into the hands of children or others who might be struggling with mental health issues. We need to normalize talking about this, and by making this an established part of Alaska's statewide suicide prevention plan, and we can do that. Again, I would like to also comment, it's wonderful that when we have schools that have no bullying or parents that are totally involved and have already locked up the guns, but we need to realize that is not everywhere in Alaska, and we need to make this easy and accessible for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Michelle. Next up, we have Rochelle Parker in Anchorage. Rochelle, welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Rochelle Parker, and I am calling from Anchorage, and I am representing myself, and I'm calling in today in support of Senate Bill 206. Firearms, like many have said, are the leading cause of death for Alaskan children and teens, and more than half of the gun deaths for these kids are suicides. And like we've heard, because firearm suicide is so uniquely lethal, it's so important that we increase our education efforts and access to secure gun storage to put critical time and space between a person in crisis and a deadly weapon. And as we've also heard, often a delay of 10 minutes can save a person's life. I'm calling today because I've also been a volunteer for the past several years, working particularly with the Be Smart for Kids program, sharing information about secure storage with school districts across Alaska, and offering cable locks to families in need. I've worked particularly here in the Anchorage School District, and we've also established a partnership with the Association of Alaska School Boards. And in that capacity, I have met school counselors, school nurses, and administrators from Anchorage to Ketchikan to Kalskag and beyond, all across the state, who have requested educational literature encouraging secure gun storage and cable locks for their students. However, our volunteer pool is small, and our effort has been largely limited by the number of volunteers we have to do the work and whether schools are even aware of the secure storage resources that are available to these students. So I find this bill to be so encouraging because it would institutionalize these efforts, providing more equitable access to secure storage education and low-cost devices like cable locks that can help students who are vulnerable. And it falls in line with the Alaska Statewide Suicide Prevention Plan. So I believe if we have the ability to save a young person's life, especially a young person who may be experiencing bullying or harassment or considering suicide, then we have the responsibility to do so. So thank you, Senator Tobin. I urge you to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Rochelle. Our last person to testify today will be Jody Gaddy. She's calling in from Juneau. Jody?
Hi, yeah, this is Jody Gaddy. I'm calling from Juneau. I was just in the room, but I had to leave to go pick up my child. But my name is Jody, and I support SB 206. I just wanted to start with a personal story. When I was in high school, I had four of my classmates commit suicide, one right after the other. And two of these classmates used a firearm to end their own life. I remember at the time asking school administrators what their plan was and, you know, what was going on, what could we do about this? And he said that they wouldn't address it because they were worried that it would make the problem worse, just really antiquated thinking about suicide. However, if we had something like this, I wonder what would have happened. Would this have delayed the issue? Would some of my classmates still be here? And so I'm sharing those things today in strong support of SB 206, and I thank Senator Tobin for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you, Jody, for your testimony. I see no one else online wishing to testify. One last check in the room. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. I want to again let the committee know that Captain Scott Bartlett is online. Captain, Alaska State Troopers, if anyone has any questions. Seeing none, thank you, Captain Bartlett, for being available online. So with that, we have completed public testimony for this bill. I'm going to set the bill aside for future consideration. And so that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, February 26th, again at 3:30. At that time, we'll be hearing a presentation from Facing Foster Care, in Alaska. So with that, this will conclude our meeting today. Let the record reflect that the time is 4:56 p.m.